basketball fans, welcome to We The Rapscast, coming at you on Dash Radio. You can find us on Dash at 4 p.m. Eastern every Tuesday and in podcast form on iTunes, Stitcher, Podcast Addict, and anywhere else you get podcasts into your ear holes. I'm Dan Grant at Slammin' Danny G on Twitter, and with me as always is a man who often feels like a small town girl living in a lonely world. It's my man at Rusty Pedal Bike, Russell Pedal, and he just won't stop believing. Russell, how are you?
I'm great, Dan, man. I'm feeling really good. I just watched basically the most complete game the Raptors put up all season, I think, in Game 5 against the Bucks. So I'm feeling pretty good. Pretty good.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I saw on Twitter, Eric Kurien mentioned that was probably the first easy Raptors home victory in the playoffs since Vince dropped 50. And that was when I was in grade 11. And I am now married. So,
yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, so it was pretty cool. I think everyone kind of expected the other shoe to drop, maybe the Bucks to make a run, and they made a couple little ones, but it was a pretty comfortable win, all things considered.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty wire to wire, too. Like, the Bucks had very little time in front.
Yeah, I think it might have been one. Oh, no, they went up 9-8, I think, or 8-7 at one point, the Bucks did. But other than that, I think the Raptors were in front the whole game.
Yeah, exactly. And they just got contributions across the board. It's one of those things where I feel like anytime we analyze a Raptors game, there's talk of, like, okay, the stars were on, but who was the third guy? Or, you know, we were getting contributions from the bench, but one of the stars was cold or really like shot them out of the game or something like that. And this just had a bit of everything, just enough Kyle and DeMar, and like everyone else contributed exactly what you'd want or more from them. Like you could look at it and say like, oh, Patterson only had 5 points, but I mean, he had a three and you know, you can only play so many players. So
totally. Yeah. I mean, what do you want? You can't have like, you're not gonna have nine guys in double figures.
No, that's it. And we're at the point now where, as we've talked about numerous times on this show, the Raptors just have, they're a deep team. So like there are some guys, good players that are not going to get minutes some games. And, you know, the first three games that was Norman Powell. And now it seems to be Patrick Patterson who's getting the short end of the stick. But when you've got guys like Ibaka and like if Carroll plays like he did in game five, then, you know, you let the flow dictate your rotation a little bit.
Absolutely, and it's totally fine to have that happen. That's, you know, the bench role. You gotta look for the guys who have it that night, and you know, that's it. That's really their job, is to step up when the starters either falter or when you need a different look or something like that. And the bench is doing that, or did it tonight anyway. And that's a really huge thing. I wrote the game preview before game three, which was obviously an abomination, and we'll get back to that in a minute. I don't think we need to talk too much about that, but I did write a preview of just basically saying that the Raptors, when their bench is good, that's when they're good, because they have so much depth, and that's something we've talked about so much. We talked about it leading into the playoffs, how this is the deepest, you know, 1-10 Raptors team that's ever existed, and that was missing in the Raptors' losses in this game. There was not a lot. I mean, the stars obviously struggled. You know, famously, DeRozan and Lowry have had troubles in the playoffs, and that looked like it was going to be a little bit more of the same, but the other guys weren't doing much either. There wasn't, you know, any kind of secondary help, any kind of person stepping up. So to see that kind of a really deep team win tonight was just fantastic.
Yeah. I think it's important to point out too, that whenever people are listening to this, and there are many ways, of course, you can listen to us, as Dan mentioned up off the top. But we're recording this right after Game 5, so this is a fresh take, and you might hear us say, you know, tonight and just now a lot, but we're referring to the game, and you might be listening to this the next day. I just think it's important to clarify that.
Absolutely, yeah. We're recording Monday night, and this will be live on Dash Radio on Tuesday afternoon. So, that's important to understand, definitely. So Game 5, obviously, was fantastic. The series so far, Russell, how are you feeling about the series? Obviously, the Raptors have won two in a row and have some positive momentum, as much as momentum exists game to game, which doesn't ever seem to exist game to game for the Raptors in the playoffs. No. So how are you feeling about the series heading into Game 6?
Feeling pretty good right now, I have to say. It's funny because since we last recorded, this show. Mm-hmm. It has been a real roller coaster of emotions because the last
up and down.
Oh my Lord! The last time we recorded was after a game one loss, which was like felt totally dejected. Didn't feel like I could feel any worse. But then game three happened, and
yes.
the Raptors just got absolutely eviscerated, and it was horrible. And honestly, the worst loss I've ever seen the team suffer.
Yeah,
and then
it was awful.
Go ahead.
I was gonna say even game two when they won. It basically felt very similar to game one, except that the shots went in. And when, you know, they made a bunch of threes where they didn't make any shots in the second half of game one. So when you looked at games one, two, and three altogether, I wasn't feeling good. And you could tell that via Twitter and other social media and all over the place, Raptors fans were not feeling good after especially that disgusting blowout in game three.
Yeah, there's been a lot of conversation about, like, obviously where the team goes from here, the situation with the four free agents this summer and people saying like, you know, to lose another, if you lose it in the first round, why would you go so far into the tax? And then you look at Casey's job and all this stuff. So, you know, each like quarter, each half, each game feels like this team is playing to stay together. And like, that was a big thing in game four. Like they're down 2-1 in the series. They played a fairly even game. This was on Saturday. And it was like one of those things where like, okay, they have to basically win this half. Cause if they go down 3-1, they don't have a very good chance of advancing. And then like basically the iteration of the team that we've seen a lot these last 3 or 4 years, pretty much ends, right? Like it has to, like you just don't see them running it back with those results. And this Bucks team just has seemed like such a challenging matchup. And, you know, it was a bad draw for the Raptors, it turns out. And we were talking about that before the playoffs. This wasn't exactly the team we wanted. I didn't expect them to be this good, but I really underestimated Giannis and just the overall length of the team, right? And Giannis Antetokounmpo is just a superstar and is by far has been the best player in this series. And we conceded that coming in, but I didn't realize just how much that would be true and just how much the length would matter the rest of the way down the roster. And, yeah, there have certainly been several moments in this series where I felt legitimately like the Raptors could lose, and obviously they still could, but I think that they've done just enough and we've gotten enough. Like, the performances out of DeMar and Kyle, while there have been bad moments and bad games, obviously DeMar's game three was atrocious, somehow it still doesn't feel as bad as last year where every game just seemed really bad from both of them. And it was like this continuous trend. Like now there's a thing where the Raptors don't quite have it, but it doesn't just come down to the same thing every game. Like it's not the same problem every time.
It's more of a safety net.
Yeah. And it's weird. Cause I kind of take solace in that. Like you can make game to game adjustments as long as it's not a fundamental problem with the team. And I mean, some people might argue that there is a fundamental problem with the team or there are fundamental problems, but I feel like each loss you can kind of like learn some stuff from it and then move on. It's not something that, you know, nothing has stuck out in this series other than the fact that it's a challenging matchup and, you know, we might even see the Raptors play better and look better against, if they had managed to advance, to look better against the Cavaliers than they did in this Bucks series until tonight, right?
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. I mean, when you want to go back to you're talking about Giannis, I don't think I realized what a dynamic defensive player he is. I know he's obviously the Greek freak and he's so athletic and he gets shots, you know, he blocks shots and gets steals and that kind of stuff. But the way he does it is so emphatic that it's pretty mind-boggling. He comes out of nowhere with these help blocks. He can kind of cross the court in like two steps and just, you know, vanquish plays that he has no business really doing. It's a huge difference maker. And if he can improve, you know, even marginally on the positional side with that kind of thing, and they can get him some help in terms of a big man or anything to play alongside him, like other than, you know, a better defensive big man, I mean, they're going to be a really, really tough team for years to come. I mean, he's only 22 years old, like you said, and he's just been such a force of nature the entire series.
Yeah, it's just it's amazing to mention his age.
Yeah.
Like he's just looked like so composed, and even like when he's having a bad game and he has a bad shooting night, like you look at you look at game four, and he was he shot 6 for 19,
mm-hmm.
but only scored 14 points. Like, but then he also had 9 rebounds, 4 assists, 2 steals, 2 blocks.
Yeah. It's a fantastic game for a lot of players.
Exactly. So he's a big impact player. So that's one thing I've really learned from this series. And I knew he was good, and I watched him a lot this year. And, you know, he was a true, you know, he's really broken out into that superstar tier, really. Mm-hmm. He's really something else. But I didn't realize to what point, like, in the playoffs, like, when you see a really good player, like, it takes a while for them to get to the point where they can really take over a series. Like that, especially at his age. But, you know, win or lose this series, the Bucks have to be very, very, very happy with him.
Totally. And I think you can see they have like 75 to 80% of their formula with him and Brogdon and the shooters, Dellavedova, you know, as McCurr develops more, the athleticism they have is pretty unbelievable. And if they can just add a couple more pieces, you know, I don't know if Monroe is going to stick around after the year, but if they can add some veteran kind of guys around them, they're going to be, you know, if you improve that Jason Terry spot, if you improve that Michael Beasley spot, they're going to be a really nasty, nasty team to play.
And that's the thing that this series does for them, is that it's like it's an audition tape, right? Because you're going to get people now that will want to play there and replace that Jason Terry slot and stuff like that. And maybe suddenly a guy like Greg Monroe, who's been, you know, kind of like not really a fit with the team all this time, like he's kind of carved out a role for himself on the bench. And he's been really impactful in this series as well. So, you know, if he sticks around, that's a good guy to have as your backup center type deal. And like you said, McCurr's development, Brogdon's development, like all these guys are far from their ceiling. And this is all without talking about Jabari Parker. Now, you know, he's had 2 ACL tears, so you're kind of worried about that. And if he's going to have the same, ever going to have the same explosiveness or ever be able to go up to the rim without feeling like he's going to tear something. But, you know, the pieces are there to make this a really interesting free agent destination this summer. Now, I don't mean to be talking past the Bucks, because they're obviously still...
I was just going to say the same thing. Yeah,
they're still a threat to win Game 6 and this series.
Yeah.
But I don't feel... I definitely don't feel comfortable. Like, I'm not like, okay, the Raptors can start thinking about Cleveland now. Not at all. I think they're in a good position, and they're lucky to be in it after, you know, this is the first lead they've had in this series.
Sure.
So let's see how they play with that. And we know that... you know, the Raptors, this iteration has historically had problems putting away teams, especially in games and in series. Yeah. So
game sixes in particular.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, this game on the road, not feeling particularly, strong about it, but I'd love for them to prove me wrong.
Yeah, for sure. And that's, I think I want to just, clarify when we're talking about the Bucks' future, that was all respect. There was nothing, to do with, you know, looking past them for me, and I know for you, as you just said. So I think we're just kind of...
just blown away by the team, really.
Yeah, like, talking about how much better than they are than I thought they were going to be.
Exactly. I underestimated them for sure. We definitely have recordings of this show to go back on that I'll be embarrassed to listen to, simply because I said I wasn't concerned about the Bucks, and obviously I should have been. And the Raptors should have been, too, because I don't think... Yeah, and I don't think the Raptors were properly prepared for this team either. When you look at something like Game 3, like, honestly, one of the worst performances I've ever seen, you know, a favored team have in a playoff game.
Yeah, it was unbelievable.
It was horrible. Like, I hate to even think about it. Like, it was a dark time. Like I said, it's amazing that in the run of 1 week, the highs of like a game like this one, which felt like right up there with that, like. Mm-hmm. With last year's game 5 at this exact time, the other Norm game.
Yeah.
like that whole thing. And, you know, obviously one of the most exciting games this season, one of the most complete games, as I said off the top. And then to put that up against that game 3, where it was like, I was just, I don't know, like I really... Sincerely, I think the thing at the root of all this is I sincerely love this Raptors team. Like, I actually really, really like the roster. I like the players. I like the coach. I like, you know, the rebranding, the jerseys, the, like, I think this is one of the times in you know, the span of my 22 years of Raptors fandom where I've really legitimately loved the team and not wanted to change, like, just I want it to be good because I want it to stick. So, you know, I'm invested. So seeing the types of performances that we got out of the team in game one and game three, it's tough. Like, it's emotionally draining because you're you spend so much time defending the team and talking them up and analyzing them and, you know, kind of always looking for the positives. Like, to analyze a team, you have to kind of look at both sides and look at the positives and the negatives. And a lot of us that cover the team do that. But I do find I trend towards wanting to defend the team. And I don't know what it is about me or my fandom, but I have always felt that way where I always want to find the positive and bring it up. But it was hard to find positives after those games. So, and even like the two wins, like you mentioned, game two and game four, there were moments where they very easily could have pissed those games away. Right.
Totally. Absolutely.
The only exception being this game, what was great in this one in game five was that every counter punch the Bucks had, the Raptors had another counter for that. So it was just, yeah, if they can bottle something from this game and not like rest on their laurels in game six, then it would be good because you've got a very rested Cavs team for next weekend.
Yeah. And they didn't, you know, it's funny, like when you were watching, the Bucks made this little mini 9-0 run when the Raptors were up 19 in the first half and they got it back to 10. And it was basically the feeling, if you were on Raptors Twitter, was kind of, here we go again. And like Blake Murphy had a great tweet where he said, the Raptors, what did he say? Oh yeah, the Raptors haven't taken their foot off the gas. They've dropped their cell phone between the pedals and are trying to get it without stopping the car.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it was wonderful. It made me laugh really hard. But you also, you know, you laugh with 80% joy, but also 20% terror because you're like, this is typical.
It's apt.
Like, this is, yeah, it's exactly. So the fact that, as you said, they were able to come back and just pull it out, and it was just really nice. With that said, you're talking about positives in the series, and I think it's an important thing. One of the things I asked you to do, and I'm going to do the same thing, is I want to talk about some of the most impactful players in the series. So if you don't mind, Russell, I know you've picked three players and I've picked three players, so when we made sure we didn't have any overlap here. If you could lead it off with someone I don't think you'll have trouble talking positively about, and that is Mr. Serge Ibaka.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, arguably, like, yes, Norman Powell has been a revelation these last two games. But really, the best player in this series on the Raptors side of the ball has certainly been Serge Ibaka, like the most consistent. He's contributing in different ways every game, even when he's having an off shooting night. Like, you know, he had an off game in game four, shot four for 16 from the field, but still had, like, you know, 8 rebounds, 2 steals, 3 blocks. And that's just really been the story. If he hasn't been nailing threes and, you know, blocking tons of shots and really protecting the rim, he's been finding other ways to contribute. And that's the thing. Like, you need that. You need that constant. And, you know, DeMar's had his off games. Kyle's had his off games. You know, they've both had one major dud in particular. Like, Kyle Lowry had a terrible game one, and DeMar DeRozan had a terrible game three. And Serge Ibaka has just found a way to not have a terrible game, right? He's his three-point shooting percentage is not that great on the series as a whole. It's under 30%. It's kind of bad for him. But, you know, that 0-for-5 game four obviously doesn't help. But, you know, he shot 46% from the field. He's averaging 14 points, 7.6 rebounds. But the 2.4 blocks and the rim protection that he's giving the team is just massive. So I just think it can't be stated enough that you know, I think because in the past, in other playoff runs, it's always like looking for that third guy. Who's going to be that third guy? So after Kyle and DeMar. And sometimes it's Jonas Valanciunas, sometimes it's, you know, Patrick Patterson, what have you. And you kind of wanted it to be Damari Carroll, but it almost never was. Serge Ibaka has been that consistently there as that third guy, sometimes the second guy if one of the other guys falls off. So his impact on the series, the Raptors obviously wouldn't be where they are without him, because he's been huge.
Yeah, I made a comment to somebody the other day. I can't remember who it was. The thing for me that Ibaka does that I love the most is he makes plays that I'm not conditioned to expect as a Raptors fan. He's unlike any player that I remember us ever having in that he makes these fantastic, he recovers and makes blocks. He gets loose balls when you don't think he's going to. He makes just smart little touch passes and things where if you saw any other Raptor in history, like trying to make these kinds of plays, they would either end in a foul or a turnover or just something. And I know that's silly, but it's also just so, I find him doing things that make me go, oh no, oh yes, like all the time. But he knows what he's doing. It's not like he's making the incorrect play. It's just that I'm incorrectly conditioned to having this wrong response. And his athleticism inside is just so tremendous. And the fact that he's not a one-way guy, right? We had a guy like Biombo last year who made some fantastic defensive plays, but was basically just a dunker, if even that, on the offensive end. The fact that he makes these long, you know, he makes long twos, he makes little turnarounds, he makes nice little touch passes. He's always looking to make the right play on offense, but he just does everything well. And it's such an odd feeling as a Raptors fan, because we never really had Chris Bosh when he could stretch it out to three. He was more of a, and he was also the dominant guy in the team. It was a lot of post-up plays and run for him. Having Ibaka play the way he is as a complimentary piece is just such a nice luxury for Raptors fans and for me. Yeah,
that's really well put. there are a lot of moments like that where he recovers on like a, someone makes a bad switch and you're like, okay, who, like you see Giannis going to the rim, but then Serge is there to clean it up. And yeah, he makes a lot of really smart plays. And he, like, just to put it this way, he's facing a whopping 11 shots at the rim per game.
Mm-hmm.
And his opponents are only, the Bucks are shooting 34.1% at the rim against him.
Wow.
That's
awesome.
That's so huge. Good. I mean, that's a, yeah. to have a rim protector like that is just, it's what you need, right? Like, especially with a team like the Bucks that, yeah, they stretch the floor really well, but their biggest weapon, Giannis Antetokounmpo, is a beast at the rim. And so you need someone there to protect the rim, and they've got it. So
that's
massive.
Yeah, and I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I remember when the Raptors acquired Ibaka, there was a lot of talk that his rim protection numbers had gone through the floor in Orlando. And people were wondering, well, is that just because Orlando is so garbage and like didn't know how to play him? And maybe he's playing with Vucevic or Biombo or whoever, and he's not playing inside as much. There was a lot of talk about whether or not he could still do it. And obviously, you said he's averaging almost 2.5 blocks a game in this series. And just the threat of him inside, you can see him changing shots all the time.
And yeah, it's, you have to
it's awesome. Yep.
It is really awesome. You have to think that like the whole Orlando thing and the drop off there wasn't actually a drop off as much as it is, you know, situational.
Sure.
You don't want to say that he like quit on Orlando or didn't put in the same effort there, but it's just different circumstances on a team that's like clearly lottery bound and lacking direction versus a playoff team. And in this case, a team in the playoffs in actual meaningful games. Like, this is a guy that played, you know, many years in Oklahoma City and played a lot of playoff games with OKC.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can tell he's got that extra gear when it comes to the game, when the games really matter. So
totally. Well, he in the conference finals last year, he was unbelievable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you can kind of, you go back and look at all kinds of, you can pick all kinds of examples, different playoff series against the Spurs and stuff like that, where he was a deciding factor. He was like, you know, like I think back to a couple of years ago when he was injured and he missed the first couple of games against the Spurs and he came back and Thunder came roaring back. Like, he was such a factor.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's it. He's in today's NBA, I mean, a rim protector that can stretch the floor so well. It's a coveted piece, and it's obviously the piece that this team has wanted for the last few years. And it's just amazing to think back to when, you know, this very season, Pascal Siakam was the starting power forward for the majority of the year.
Yeah. And now he started 38 games, I think.
Yeah.
Something like that. Maybe that's numbers too high. But he was in the rotation for half the season. Yeah, now he doesn't even get in there. I actually have a listener, Pascal Siakam, question later on.
Yeah, cool.
So I will, we'll get back to Pascal again. All right, I want to go on to my first impact player, and we talk about the Bucks for a little bit here before circling back to our Raptors. And I just wanted to talk about Thon Maker, who the stats don't really bear out what I want to talk about. It's more just watching him play. Because, again, we were talking about it a little bit with Giannis before about how we didn't, you know, there's things you don't realize. And McCurr obviously didn't even start or play a whole lot for the Bucks for a lot of the year. He looks like he has all the tools to be an absolutely unbelievable NBA player. And the fact that he went so high in the draft was a really big surprise to a lot of people. I think the questions about how old he really is, he's listed as 20 right now. I think he was 19 when he got drafted. He played up here in Canada at Orangeville Prep last year, which I found out is not actually even a school. It's just a team called Orangeville Prep, and then they can go to a different school. So it's a weird kind of basketball factory at a suburb of Toronto. Anyway, he's just had such an odd journey to the NBA that I was highly skeptical of him coming in or of whether or not he'd be good this soon. But they were talking about on the broadcast today, Jack Armstrong and Matt Devlin were talking about how Jason Kidd flat out said, you know, we don't have a D-League team. So we didn't want to waste this year for him. So we were going to get him minutes wherever we could. And I think that's just them being really practical and knowing if they won their first round series, that's a bonus for them this year in terms of the development of the team and how young their guys are. And so for him to get out there, he's playing over 20 minutes a game. And you see the mistakes, you see little things, he jumps sometimes and he tries, he's so athletic that he's trying to make every play, but he's good, man. Like he makes instinctual plays, little things. He shows you those little flashes where once he gets smarter and once he learns how to, you know, rotate properly and stay in good position, once he adds some weight, cause he obviously looks like he weighs 110 pounds. He's just got such fantastic athleticism that you don't often see in a guy who's 7'1". He's also 7'1". I always look at him and think that he's, you know, 6'10", 6'11", but he's listed at 7'1". And when you see him running the break, he had a fast break dunk, and I think it was in game 3. And he was out running, you know, the forwards and guards of the Raptors at 7'1". And they're chasing him down, and they were at his shoulders and at, like, you know, maybe his chin. So I think it's legit, his height. So he might not even be done growing. And he's for me the biggest surprise of the series in terms of a guy that I kind of expected to start, play a few minutes, and then maybe we'd see more Monroe, even though we're seeing or see John Henson or even see Antetokounmpo at the 5. And then we haven't seen any of that because he's been giving them decent minutes anyway. And the fact that he's doing it at this age is pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, he's another one that it's funny that when you look at, like you mentioned about the draft and how he was picked probably higher than most people would have had him. And, you know, what did we really have on him to know what he would be? And it's just funny that it's like, it's the same story as Antetokounmpo all over again. And it's the same team, the same pick, basically. And Lightning really struck twice with them.
Yeah, seems like it. And it's pretty cool that I like when people have the philosophy, and I subscribe to this in fantasy sports a lot of the time. If you have a guy that you want, go get him. Like, take him. People are worried too much about, I think, you know, projections and, oh, this is the guy we have to take in this spot, and this is, you know, whatever. And you see Masai Ujiri has done it a few times too. Mm-hmm. Go get your guy. And you know what? Sometimes it works, sometimes it won't, but at least you know, and at least you trusted your own scouting staff and what you want. So don't pick, you know, people say they'll pick the best available player, and I guess how they determine that kind of affects that strategy. But I like it when teams take risks like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if they had picked 5 picks lower, then it might have been more acceptable to throw the dart, right? But they did it at 15, and was it at 15 they took him?
10,
right. To do that, and it's like, okay, if they had picked even, yeah, 5 lower at 15 or 10 lower at 20, mm-hmm. it, like, no one would have blinked, but because it was so high. But I mean, like you said, you take your guy. I mean, if you want him, like, it, you could pick the sure thing or what you think is the sure thing, and he becomes a dud. Like, there are second, third overall guys that don't pan out. So at the end of the day, like, don't be influenced by all those other things. And I mean, like, you know, they're showing now that they've got a bit of a history of picking guys, right? Like, they've got Giannis, him, Brogdon, all guys that are turning out better than their draft stock would have originally projected. And totally. You know, with McCurr, like you said, he's playing big minutes in the, in this series. He's putting up per 36. He's playing 20 minutes a night, but his per 36 numbers: 11.5 points, 6 rebounds, 1.7 steals, 2.1 blocks, mm-hmm. and he's protecting the rim. Like we were talking about how Serge Ibaka is protecting the rim, and he's out there only allowing the Raptors to shoot 32% at the rim in the 6 shots he's facing per game. So that's, you know, that's pretty massive as well. And as a young guy, like who doesn't have the experience doing that, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so we're going to move on to a man, Russ, that you chose. A tweet from Raptors HQ, Sean Woodley, and Locked On Raptors host Sean Woodley earlier said, "When Tony Snell retires, I'm going to throw a party and invite everyone except for Tony Snell."
Yeah.
So, Russ, you wanted to talk about Tony Snell. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's not even... He's that guy in this series, and it happens in some playoff series where you just have this guy that, you know, you're not necessarily, you didn't really scout for, you didn't think was going to be a big issue, and he just makes a massive impact. And it, like the whole concept of having slept on the Bucks, like I really feel like we slept on Tony Snell, and obviously he's playing out of his mind and much better than, you know, his actual stats would tell you, and sure, anyone who's watched him. But there's, it's funny, this idea that he's a former Bull, and yeah, like the way that yeah, the Bulls yeah, always kill the Raptors. So
yeah, I hadn't even thought about that.
So that's kind of funny. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But not to mention that the Bulls desperately need 3-point shooting, and he's turned into like Ray Allen all of a sudden. But
yeah, he's shooting 53.3% on three for the series, like six attempts a game.
Like that's just simply unreal. Like,
yeah,
you look at their starting lineup. Like you look at Malcolm Brogdon as a potential rookie of the year. You look at Giannis Antetokounmpo as the potential most improved player, and like this absolute superstar. As we said, we've talked about Chris Middleton's impact on the Bucks since his return, and how good they've been since he came back from injury, and you know Thon McCurr, and then how, you know, what he's giving the team. And then I think to me, even just the starting lineup, but even, you know, go a couple deep on the bench, Tony Snell was a complete afterthought for me in this series. And mm-hmm. I feel like every time he gets the ball, I just throw my hands up and
yeah,
I'm like, ugh.
Yeah. 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 And there was that game two, when the Raptors pulled out that win and, you know, they only won by 6, and Delly and someone else missed an open three. Delly missed a wide open three at the end of the game. And Snell had been murdering the Raptors earlier, and he was nailed to the bench. And people, you know, really second-guessed that move by Jason Kidd. And obviously, he's played pretty significant minutes for them since then. He's playing, let me see here.
Over 30, 30.
Yeah, over 30 minutes. Yeah, 30.7 minutes in the series. So if you told me at the All-Star break Tony Snell was going to be an X factor in a first-round series, I would have laughed at you.
I didn't see him mentioned in a single preview I read coming into the series.
No.
Not once.
No, he was just going to be a guy, like a warm body for them. I think he was mentioned, they're like, well, at least they have, you know, Antetokounmpo and Brogdon, and that's it, really, and he'll be one of the other guys. It was a Josie and the Pussycat situation. But he's been awesome for them, and it's weird. Yeah, as you said, the former Bull. But they kind of just gave him away for Michael Carter-Williams, who's been not very good at all for them.
Yeah.
So really another astute front office move by the Bucks.
Yeah, they've had a lot of hits. If we're, you know, the Norm Powell trade notwithstanding.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was a good one for us. So we'll take that one.
Yep.
Yeah. For those listening that maybe not remember that, but the Raptors traded Grievous Vasquez to the Bucks a couple years ago. Received the second-round pick they used for Norm Powell and the first-round pick that they just sent to Orlando as part of the Serge Ibaka trade. So for all the compliments...
It's the cruel irony of this series if the Raptors win, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, for all the compliments we've been giving the Bucks front office, that one is not looking so good for them, at least for this year.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, we're going to move on to the fourth player here, which is my second guy, and that's Mr. DeMar DeRozan. And the biggest thing I want to talk about with DeRozan is his response to the absolute egg the team laid in Game 3. Obviously, it was a terrible game for him. He was 0 for 8 from the field, only had 8 points, all free throws. There was the whole famous Giannis thing, saying all free throws of the press conference after that. And, you know, I heard a stat, I think it was on a Ringer podcast, where they were saying that, I think it was Tate Frazier busted it out, saying that no player who had ever averaged 25 a game in NBA history had ever had a game in the playoffs where they didn't make a field goal. So, pretty nasty little, he wasn't saying it in a nasty way. He was just saying it was just kind of an insane aberration. And his response the next day was my favorite thing, which was, I love that DeRozan's quiet kind of confidence and his pride. Obviously he works so hard on his game all the time, and yes, he has flaws. We know that, but he's a guy who really, really cares, and having him on your team and a guy who cares like that is awesome. For me personally, I really respect the hell out of him. And the fact that he came out the next morning and he didn't pull any punches. He said, that was embarrassing. I'm embarrassed. We played horribly and that's not going to happen again. And then he came out in game four and was fantastic.
He was fabulous.
Just unbelievable. His defense obviously is still not great, but he, just on the offensive end, the fact that he just took such a load. And it was such a grinded out, hard-fought game. Neither team was really making threes. And he just took it to the rim again and again and again. And he made that beautiful reverse. Mm-hmm. That was just unbelievable. And the fact that he's responded in that way is a thing that really... I think it matters. It matters that, you know, he didn't just wilt. And a lot of players could have. And maybe he would have 2 years ago. Who knows? But the fact that he's worked on his game and built himself up and got to the point where he can say, no, enough of this. And then tonight, another great game. They started doubling him really hard again, and he played within himself. He moved the ball. He, you know, found some open guys. He made some timely shots. He made that three at the end. He had the big dunk. But he didn't try to force anything. He played within the team concept. And again, DeRozan 3 or 4 years ago, when he was black hole DeRozan averaging like one assist a game, wouldn't have been able to do that. So the fact that he's worked to put himself in the position to be this good and this versatile now on offense is just a cool thing to watch. It's a really cool thing to see him grow so much as a player.
Yeah, absolutely. He's honestly one of my favorite things about the Raptors franchise, honestly, in the whole history of the team is him. He's completely homegrown here. Mm-hmm. You know, when drafted, you know, the type of player he was, it was like, you know, it seemed like he was just going to be kind of a Kobe wannabe with no range.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not much to really sink your teeth into. And then, you know, all this talk of like, oh, if he's your best player, then it's, you're not in good shape and all this stuff. And like you said, just the constant development, like always adding stuff to his game, always finding ways to work through his limitations in certain ways. Like the fact that he doesn't have range as a shooter, you know, and he was once people would say like, you know, oh, he's just a dunker or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he's just found he's a facilitator. He doesn't force stuff. Like you said, you know, tonight he was getting doubled up and he only took 14 shots. You know, and he hit half of them. So, and even, you know, even the game, he went 0 for 8. He only took 8 shots. He didn't hoist up 20 shots.
No.
Right? Yeah. Like, there's something to be said for that. As much as I don't want to look at that game as a good example of his play. Yeah, he's been great in this series when he, like, that terrible game notwithstanding. But just in general, he's a guy that, you know, you're proud to have as a Raptor. Because, yeah, he's just, he's worked hard and he cares. Give a shit meter is off the charts.
As much as
he seems calm and cool and collected, like he takes this stuff personally. Like when, you know, I think that because of the era that we're in right now in basketball, the fact that he doesn't have a shot is supposed to make him, you know, just not an excellent player, like not a all-star caliber player. But he's proven those people wrong. And as much as people can look at him and say, oh, he forces shots and he's not good. And, you know, all this is like the way that he plays is not right. And
it's a
dying thing and everything like that. But he makes it work, man. He really does. And he's come such a long way. And I can think of all the times that I, you know, I really wanted the team to go away from DeRozan and like,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
But the last few years, he's completely won me over. Like I'm going to be, I'm going to be really, really sad when he stops being a Raptor someday.
Yeah.
Like, maybe he'll retire a Raptor, and that'd be great because, you know what, I think regardless of what you think of Vince or Bosch or, you know, even Lowry, there's something to be said. Like, if, like, let's say DeRozan ends up being the first jersey retired for, I know we're getting way ahead of, like, you're talking about getting ahead of this series, but
it's legit though. It's a legit thing, like, to talk about.
Yeah. If he ends up being the first jersey to go up in the rafters, I think that's really something because, like, you know, he was raised by the team, and it's not only can he kind of toes that line between one of the best star players, obviously one of the best scorers the team has ever had, you know, multiple time all-star, but also like a fan favorite. As much as like he's had detractors over the years, like he's won a lot of people over, and I'd say he has a lot more supporters than detractors now, and the ones that are still detractors are people that haven't been paying enough attention to how he's grown.
I think casual fans also, he has a lot of fans among casual fans. They absolutely love him from talking to people like my friend's parents and people who, you know, only watch the playoffs or only watch once in a while. They love him.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that, you know, that's a guy that kind of toes that line between star and fan favorite. So to have those two things, I think he's got, you know, he used to be such a polarizing player, whereas now I think that we've really all shifted to one side. We're on his side now. So
totally. And I think that's another example. He's a good example of a guy who was one and done. And he even talked about it. He said he should have stayed another year in school, but his mom is like, he's very open about this. His mom has lupus and is sick, and he wanted to make money to help pay for that and to help get her better treatment. And he went to the NBA before he might have. Well, he doesn't know. Like, he didn't say, I definitely would have stayed, but, you know, he needed to develop more, but he made the jump. And as so many other guys have when they, you know, have to support people. And the fact that, you know, he's still young, he's only 27.
Yeah.
So if he'd been a 4-year pro, he'd only be in his fourth or fifth year now, 4-year college player, excuse me. It's really cool. He's, as you were saying, he's homegrown. He's the only, I think the first guy to sign a third contract with the Raptors.
That's interesting. I never knew that.
Yeah. I don't know, unless there's, you know, some guy who signed some shorter term ones, but you know, all those guys, you know, Vince signed his second big deal and then he requested to be traded in the middle of it. Bosch signed his rookie deal and then one extension and then he was gone. You know, obviously guys like Camby and Stoudemire were gone at the end of their first deal. So
McGrady.
Yeah. Oh God. And yeah, anyway, we don't need to go down this memory lane, but the fact that he's doing this, and it's really worthy to start talking about him in that way, because if he plays to the end of this contract, he's going to be like 11, 12 years with the team. And that's, even if he doesn't stay longer than that, that's a pretty remarkable run for a team as young as the Raptors.
And he's made it clear too that he, like, you know, he wants to be in Toronto. Like, he is, if I'm not mistaken, I believe he said he wants to retire a Raptor. So.
Yeah, he has. Yeah, he said it publicly more than once.
Yeah, so I mean, he's already the franchise leader in a number of areas.
Yep.
He's really, he won me over. I there was a time when I remember one time I was at a Raptors game and I wanted to buy a jersey, and this was like 4 years ago, maybe. The Raptors were playing in Montreal, where I live. And, you know, the main jerseys for sale there were his and Valanciunas's.
Right.
And for a moment, I almost got a Valanciunas jersey, and I didn't really want to get a DeRozan jersey. I didn't. I was like, I don't feel like he's going to be a guy where, like, when I buy a jersey, there's of any player, there's this kind of thing that goes through my head of, like, you know, if I stop wearing this eventually, will it be a classic one that I can put on the wall, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there is that goes through my head. And I looked at DeRozan and I said, is this going to be a guy that I'm, like, because I have a Carter jersey, I have a Bosch jersey, I have a Lowry jersey. Now I do. And I'm like, you know, someday I'm going to have a man cave that I'm going to put, like, hang all those up. And it's funny, I didn't end up buying either one that day. And I look back on it and I'm like, I'm going to have to eventually get myself a DeRozan jersey to complete my collection, because he belongs right up there with Vince, Bosch, and Lowry as the best players the team has ever seen. So I don't know. Maybe I'll grab a Huskies one. We got to have that discussion in the off season, by the way.
We'll save that. We'll save that one. But yes, I agree. We're going to have the Huskies debate.
Yeah,
for sure. Okay, so Russ, it's your turn. And your last guy is the man of the hour, Mr. Norman Powell.
Yeah, he played one heck of a game five, man. He just like he was a highlight reel. He it's amazing the impact that he's had in these last two games. Since joining the starting lineup, like, and there are a lot of people that are like trashing Casey and being like, well, why did it take five games to do this? Maybe they would have already finished the series if it weren't for that. It's
yeah. Okay.
But it's, yeah, I know. it's one of those things. It's like, it was the right adjustment at the right time. Like you came after that embarrassing game three, you had to do something.
Yep.
And most people would have, you know, the armchair coaches looked at it and said, okay, we got to get rid of Damari Carroll and put in PJ Tucker. In fact, we have talked about that on this pod, on this show many, many times.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he said, no, I'm going to take out Valanciunas, who, you know, for all intents and purposes, I wasn't really gunning for Valanciunas to leave the lineup.
Nope.
And instead of just replacing him with another big man, like, you know, bringing Powell in and shifting Ibaka to the five and just that whole thing and the effect that had down the line on the rotation was just really incredible. And sticking with Carroll on top of it, who hadn't been playing well, and then you see the impact that he had in game five as well when everyone else was ready to put him out to pasture. Like, he was a huge factor in game five.
Yeah.
So... you know, credit to Casey for his adjustments to the rotation and, you know, for keeping cool. Cause that, you know, that's two Norman Powell games and two wins. And he has been just fabulous in those two games, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yes,
he, over those two games, he has, averaged, 18.5 points per game, shot 61% from the field. A perfect 7-for-7 from 3-point range.
It's unreal.
88.9% from the line. 4 rebounds, 4 assists, 1.5 steals, and a block per game. It's really something. And you know what? Like, you look at it and you say, okay, we kind of saw this all season last year in the playoffs, like just these flashes of brilliance from him, but sometimes he still manages to fall out of the rotation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people will get on Casey for that and say, like, well, you know, why isn't he playing Powell? Why isn't he playing Powell? Et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, that's a big part of the reason why the team was willing to trade Terrence Ross. And maybe you didn't, he's still a young guy. He's not ready to play in every situation, but just he's really composed in these big moments. And it's just incredible to see. He's done a really amazing job these last two games. And overall in the series, the swing in net rating, points scored minus points allowed per 100 possessions for when Powell's on the floor versus when he's off it is just monstrous. in 89 minutes of playing time,
significant amount of minutes.
It's not a small sample. It's enough to make to draw a conclusion out of. The Raptors have a net rating of 20.9. And that's with an offensive rating of 110 and a defensive rating under 90.
Jeez.
With him off the floor, they have an offensive rating of 94, a defensive rating of 108.5, and the net rating of negative 14.5.
What?
So we're talking like a 35-point swing per 100 possessions?
Yeah.
With him on the floor versus off. And it's just – and you know, that's the nerdy stat version of it. But I mean, you just watch the game and you can see when he's on the floor, it's just, he's making such a huge impact. He was, you know, the Raptors are a plus 23 with him on the floor in game five, they were a plus 15 with him on the floor in game four. And that's like either tied for the lead in game four or like, you know, a few points off the lead in game five, except for Kyle Lowry had a huge game five plus minus wise.
Yeah.
It's incredible. He's been amazing, and it's that thing that I think we talked about it in a previous episode where we were saying that, you know, he's a break in case of an emergency type player, and that's exactly what he was used for. And you know, eventually he'll get consistent minutes, and he's going to be a consistent rotation player on this team. I'm sure of it. But you know, as we've talked about, the team is so deep that, you know, that someone has to not play. Like right now, it's Patrick for Powell to be able to get into the game. Patrick Patterson has to miss time, and we all know how impactful and important Patrick Patterson is. So it's one of those things. Like when you come to this offseason, the same way you were willing to trade Terrence Ross because Powell was there to take his place, arguably a better player. You know, who I think if he's not already, he's almost certainly going to be. I'd say he is already though. You know, that when it comes to this this offseason, if you can't bring back the four free agents, and I mean, chances are you're not going to be able to bring back all four of them, then, you know, Powell steps up and all of a sudden he's playing more minutes. And, you know, as you see in the playoffs, he's certainly earned the right to be a rotation player on this team. And he's got a cheap contract, and yeah, he's just a diamond in the rough. Like, they really found a guy in him.
Totally. I wrote a thing about him mid-season, about Terrence Ross versus Powell. This was around Christmas. And I basically, the title of the article is Norman Powell isn't better than Terrence Ross yet. Because it was, as you said, a lot of fans were clamoring for Powell to take more time in the rotation. He was only really playing when Carroll wasn't playing in back-to-backs. And people wanted more time for him. And it's justifiable because he started out the season really hot from three. And he looked great every time he played. And a big focus of the article was that he's only playing once a week. And it's easy to be at your best when you're only playing once a week in specific matchups. And you can kind of go out and play as a starter once a week as well. So it's not like your role is uncertain in the games that you're playing. And then when he kind of got some more time after that, he struggled. He had his role was up and down, and it was kind of yo-yoing as Carroll got more healthy. And he was playing different positions because Patterson had been injured and they needed him for different things. And it was hard for him. He's a second year player. So those ebbs and flows are natural. And as you said, I think if you compare him to Terrence Ross now with the Norman Powell we saw tonight, he is a better player because he's more versatile. His defense is far better when he's going at 100%. And that defense kind of seemed to abandon him a little bit. I think he was trying to create a little too much on offense during the year. Maybe kind of leading into the All-Star break. And the fact that he's really kind of found himself, they've added, you know, the defensive pieces around him to let him kind of roam and be aggressive. Jason Kidd shouted him out after game four, saying that Powell brought a ton of energy and we're going to need to match that. Obviously, it didn't happen today. it was a really nice, it's a really nice X factor, you know, breaking case of emergency, like you said, he's the fire extinguisher.
Yeah, I mean, so, well, like let's be realistic here. He's what, like the even on his best night, he's like the fifth or sixth option. But he just that's just a testament to how deep this team is.
Totally. Okay, so we're gonna move to our final guy, and this is where I'm gonna kind of transition this into a mini Grant rant segment here. So I'm gonna talk about Damari Carroll, and I'm gonna own up to the fact that after the Game 3 abomination that we talked about. I tweeted out that Damari Carroll should not play another minute in this series or as a Raptor, which is really mean, and I'm kind of sorry that I did it, and this is my apology to Damari Carroll, who will never hear this probably, but the way he played tonight was the guy that I think a lot of the people, the Raptors management and team included, thought they were getting when they signed him. He came out in the first quarter. He was aggressive. He got some offensive rebounds. He hit open threes. He was active on defense. He was all over the place. And we've talked before about how we think that a lot of, and I do think this, a lot of his decline has been because of health. But those energy plays, those things that he was doing tonight, the little extra effort, the little being disruptive, things that he used to do all on the regular when he was in Atlanta, are things we haven't seen from him. And I don't think you can blame that on health. And I don't know if they kind of gave him an ultimatum or he sees, you know, Norm playing so well and it's infectious or what caused it, but he was great tonight. And the bar is low for him. But if he can be doing that consistently in the playoffs, it's just another weapon for a team where I mean, we talked about how Powell was you mentioned how Powell was the move into the starting lineup instead of for Casey instead of Tucker for Carroll. I still thought they could go ahead and put in Patterson or Tucker for Carroll. I thought that would be a fine secondary move. And you could still justify that. But if he's going to come out and play that way and it lets you keep the bench strong by bringing Tucker and Patterson both off the bench and you kind of just play two of the three of them, whoever's hot, that's a really nice thing for the team. And the fact that he showed up and just brought it, it was a really nice way to key the team to the victory tonight. And it was just another part of a big team win. And that was just the last part, is that I wanted to apologize because he was going to be the subject of the Grant rant this week. And the Grant rant isn't going to fly this week because all these topics that I was going to rant about keep resolving themselves. So first there was Carroll. Then there was Lowry and his comments about forcing shots, which were really passive aggressive. And there was a few things he said after game three as well. Where, you know, he didn't seem worried and blah, 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 blah. It was just a lot of, like, he's trying to be too cool for school. But I can't rant about Kyle Lowry. Like, I love Kyle Lowry, and he's obviously responded really well the last couple games. So it was just kind of two Grant rants that started and fizzled. The one guy that I'm going to focus on, though, is not a player, but a meme that was going around. And I actually have now thought maybe this is fake, but they show all these constant shots of Jurassic Park, which is the square in front of the Air Canada Center. And before game two, excuse me, after that horrible game one, there was some guy holding up a trade Lowry sign, which regardless of whether or not that's even possible at this time in the year, it's not, was just to me one of the stupidest and most disrespectful things I've ever seen. I get that the Raptors did not play well, and Lowry in particular did not have a good game in game one, but the fact that you would abandon your star player on your team, whether you want to call him the first or second best player, doesn't matter, after one game and one loss, and I get this person, if they actually believe that and were not just being an asshat, might say, well, it's been 4 years of this and blah, 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 and that's all fair, but wait till the offseason to kind of engage in that kind of stuff. During the playoffs is when your team needs you to support them. That's the whole point. That's the relationship. And if you're going to be some jackass who's trying to get on TV with a trade Lowry sign, which, again, I think it might have been a meme or something because it looked too stylized to be real.
Oh, no, no, no. That was real. Was it real? Yeah, you could see it on the... I was watching the pregame show, and all right. It was very prominently featured behind the... Behind Sid and Alvin.
Right. Okay. So fuck that guy then. Because I saw him wearing a purple Raptors jersey, one of the throwbacks. And I'm sure it was either a Carter, a McGrady, a Stoudemire, a whatever jersey.
It was a Carter, I think.
A Carter, exactly. So this guy is someone who's going to cheer for Vince Carter, who quit on the fan base and abandoned this team. But he has a problem with Kyle Lowry, who chose to re-sign here when he could have gone absolutely anywhere 3 years ago.
And will likely choose to re-sign here again.
Yeah, and that'll be his first choice, regardless of what happens. And is a guy who's been the backbone of the best, you know, era in Raptors history. So that's my grand rant. It's a little mini one about that specific person, because he's not just one person. There's lots of people like that in the fan base. And I can't stand people like that. It's just such horseshit.
Yeah, I hate that. It's basically like any franchise in any sport has those fans, right? Like after a tough loss or a tough playoff run or something like that, to really be like, all right, gotta sell off everything now and start again. Like, this isn't the team that's going to do it. And it's like,
yeah, it's almost like they want to be the first one to call the demise so that when it happens, they can say, I told you so.
That's a really good point.
I just don't understand that inclination because, well, great, you said I told you so and your team lost. Like, what did you just win? You won nothing. You're an asshole.
Yeah.
So, anyway. That's the end of the Grant rant. A lot of cursing. Sorry, guys. We work a little blue on Dash Radio sometimes. If you're listening to We The Raps Cast on Dash Radio. And we are going to now get to some of our listener questions. Now, we were talking a little bit about Dwayne Casey earlier. We had a great question from one of our friends, Sean Woodley, who we write with at Raptors HQ. And he said, let's settle this debate once and for all. Is Dwayne Casey good? Give him a score as a coach out of 10. Yeah, go ahead, Russell.
Honestly, I've always been a big fan of Casey, and I've always been a big proponent of him as a coach. And we've talked about on the show the fact that, you know, honestly, I don't know a thing about coaching. in all reality. Like, I can't sit here and say that I'm a better coach than Casey or I know better than he does. I don't. But if you look up and down the coaching situations all throughout the league, like, Casey is a top 10 guy. I think that's indisputable at this point. Like, he's obviously one of the longer tenured coaches. Yep. He's coached top 10 offenses, top 10 defenses. He's developed players. Like, you got to give him some credit in the development of guys like DeRozan and Powell and what have you. The way that he is utilized Patrick Patterson, all these things. Like, and even, you know, the way that he's handled Jonas Valanciunas. There are definitely ways that people will look at it and say, like, well, he doesn't play Powell enough, he's a bum. Or he, you know, doesn't give JV enough touches, he's a bum. Or he, you know, all these different things. But at the end of the day, the team has been very successful until this year. They had increased their win total in every single year that he had been a coach, that he's been a coach with the team. And even this year, they didn't get more than the 56 they got last year, but they still had their second consecutive 50-win season. So that's the first time that's happened in team history. And, overall, I mean, I don't know what more you want from your coach. Like, if people want to replace him, like, what are you replacing him with? Are you replacing him with, like, mid-90s Phil Jackson? Are you somehow going to convince Pop to leave the Spurs? Like, what is the game here? Like, even if you're talking about, like, guys like, you know, Spoelstra, Rick Carlisle, Brad Stevens, like, you know, these other really good coaches in the league, like, obviously they're impossible to get, and, you know, they're not, it's not like this massive, massive improvement. It's, you know, and if the alternative is to, like, maybe get someone like a Frank Vogel or like some of those mid-tier coaches, right? Like, or even lower tier coaches, depending on how you look at it, or like who's out there for you to replace him with. And obviously he has a good relationship with the players. Like Kyle Lowry has been known as a coach killer his whole career until he ended up with Casey, and like, it was rough at the early going, but like, Casey has gotten the best out of Kyle Lowry, out of DeMar DeRozan. The two of them just had their best individual seasons of their careers. He took two major trade deadline acquisitions in Serge Ibaka and PJ Tucker, and were able to seamlessly get them in the rotation while also dealing with a injury to arguably the team's best player in Kyle Lowry for a quarter of the season. He had to manage DeRozan injury and a DeRozan injury and Patterson injuries this season, and through all this he won 50 games and had a top 10 offense and defense. So what exactly does he have to do to please everyone? And if it's not him, the next guy they bring in, like, what chance does he have of pleasing everyone?
yeah. So I think when you listen to it all put together like that, it's really it makes it difficult for people to actually pick out what they want. They just want something different.
Yeah, that's really it. It's like one of those things where you sit on your couch and go, like, well, I would have played Patrick Patterson 20 minutes that game instead of 15. It's like, well, good for you. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, draw me a play.
Totally. And that's, draw me a play. Also, there's other things. Like, there's so many things we don't know, right? There's so many things as a fan that you don't know. Like, if you assume most of the people, when they think about things like that, like substitutions, they're assuming that every single player is 100% healthy every game. Mm-hmm. And maybe a guy is getting a break because he has the flu, or maybe a guy didn't get, you know, work hard in practice that day. And obviously these aren't playoff adjustments, but little things like that. People expect every coach to coach every game like it's game 7 of the finals.
Yeah.
And you just don't do that. You got to try different things. You got to experiment with different lineups. You got to move things around, and you have to give guys a chance to fail, and you have to give them a chance to fail and then also redeem themselves.
That's a good point.
Because if you don't, then you're going to be left with nothing, because there's nobody who succeeds 100% of the time. You know, the NBA, like, shooting 40% from three is really great. It means you're failing 60% of the time. just little things like that. You have to kind of give these guys more leeway with that kind of a thing. I think one of the biggest criticisms I've heard of Casey is that he's not great at making in-game adjustments. And I think that's fair.
That's fair, yeah.
But I also think that the games where you can make a tangible in-game adjustment and impact the outcome of that specific game, I don't think that happens very much.
And I think everyone just kind of assumes that if he had made the adjustment that they mentioned on Twitter, that automatically the game would have been won. Like,
right.
You can't just assume that if he had made a certain adjustment that it would have resulted in a win or a change to what was going on either. Right. So there is something to be said with being consistent as well. And he's one of the best in the game, in my opinion, honestly, and from what I've seen, he's one of the best in the game when it comes to game-to-game adjustments.
He does a great job.
He does a great job. And if he does that when he's given the ability to really think things through and analyze things, like, perhaps that's better than, you know, making decisions on the fly that aren't always going, like, if he made more changes on the fly, like, I I can be critical of him too. And the second you said, like, you know, the criticism is that he's does a poor job of in-game adjustments. I agree with that. I really do.
Yeah.
But I think that it's defensible to an extent because, you know, I think that I get the sense that Casey has a very good relationship with his players. I don't feel like he's like the Charlie Brown teacher voice to them, even after this many years. And there's something to be said there. And that's because they know what to expect from him. And he's not making all these like crazy changes in game. And players know what to expect. And if they make a change, if he makes a change, like he pulls Jonas from the starting lineup, he says, I understand that's for the team. And that's because he's been conditioned from being with Casey to look at things that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he holds his players accountable, and, you know, every now and again, there's a play, like, you know, there's been plenty of plays over the last several years where out of a timeout, like, we'll go into a Lou Williams isolation play that takes 22 seconds or something like that. And you go like, why couldn't he drop something better than that? And it's frustrating, but you know, a lot of it is personnel based too. Cause if you look at the players that the team has, and, you know, if you're someone who says like, oh, you know, I hate ISO ball and stuff like that, it's like, this team is built to be an ISO team.
Sure.
You know, pick and roll is great and all that, but like, you know, the team has a lot of strength in isolation as well. It's not a post-up team. It's a, you know what I mean? Like there's something to that. So there, you know, as much as someone can look at it and say like, I want him to do this more. It's like, do they have the personnel? Do they have the means? Are people going are the players going to buy into that? Like there are all these things that we don't know. And as you and I keep saying in these arguments, like, and it's important to say, because not everyone always gets this. Like, we don't know everything.
No. And that's the thing. I think what you're just saying, I extremely, extremely doubt that Dwayne Casey ever in like a final huddle was just like, all right, screw it, Lou, do whatever you want. Like, I think that's Lou Williams making a call.
Yeah.
And even he said after he left, he's like, that's not what we draw up.
No, because so it's like there's some kind of play that they try and they don't like it's broken and they don't get the look they want, and then they've got to improvise. There are, you know, stem B and stem C's to plays, and sometimes it is just an isolation with a player who's generally good at scoring.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's phase that into our second question. Oh, sorry, before we got to answer Sean's question, rate Casey out of 10. What would you give him as a score out of 10?
8.5.
Yeah, I'd give him I was going to say 7.5, but I think 8's fair. I think there are little things he could do better, but I think one thing that he's really great at is being like a figurehead. And I think if they ever were to replace him with a younger guy, cause he is older. If they were to replace him, say with a Jerry Stackhouse or something like that, I would love to see him stay with the organization. Cause I think he's such a great teacher.
Yeah.
And I think he's just, he just does such a good job of that kind of a thing. You see the letdown games, but I think it's because he's super old school and he expects his guys to be ready and to be professional. He's not a rah, rah, you know, let's go whatever kind of a guy, at least not that he shows to us. But he expects those dudes to be ready.
And he goes to bat for his guys and everything like that too. And like that kind of old school mentality that I really appreciate as well.
Yeah, totally. Okay. So this leads naturally into our next question, which is from Jeff McLeod. He wants to know, and he wasn't advocating for this in any way, but is there any chance, and this was asked before the game tonight, that this would be Dwayne Casey's last season as a Raptors coach? What scenarios would have to happen? So I'm going to throw a couple scenarios at you, Russ, and just, I want you to tell me if you'd fire him or keep him.
Okay.
Okay. Yep. If the Raptors lose this series in 7 games.
I asked me this question a couple of days ago, I would have said yes. I think it, if it goes to seven, and unless seven is another like embarrassing loss, like they've had two pretty embarrassing right. losses this series. If you lose it having lost three embarrassing games, I think that there mm-hmm. it's definitely on the table. But I also think Masai Ujiri is not a a panic move guy.
Nope.
Like he's not going to make that move to try and appease the fan base. I think he's got the support of MLSE. I think that, you know, based on the track record, you don't necessarily have to get rid of him. I'd say he'd be back again. If they had lost this series in convincing fashion, like four or five games to a team mm-hmm. like a Bucks team, like as we said coming into the series, we underestimated them, but they absolutely should beat them.
Mm-hmm.
And if they had lost in embarrassing fashion in a quick series, sure. And maybe that's yeah. a scenario you're about to give me. But the seven, if they lose in seven in this one, I think that they'd still bring him back.
Okay. Yeah, I think that he's earned that probably as long as it's close. But you never know. But that for me would be like a 50-50. No, maybe not 50-50, 60-40 proposition. But okay. Mm-hmm. My next one. So say they scrape through and they just barely beat the Bucks in seven. And then they go into the Cleveland series and they get eviscerated. They get swept and they lose every game by 10 or 15 points or even more.
That's a very interesting question because I think if you get past this and you go into Cleveland, I think everyone's job is safe. Like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I think mm-hmm. no matter what happens, no one thinks the Raptors are better than the Cavs. They don't have to be. If they get a win, two wins like they did last year,
yeah.
That's like, you know, that's gravy basically. Now if they get completely destroyed four games in a row but I don't think they will, but I mean, let's say mm-hmm. that they do. Yeah, I mean, it would obviously be a question. It would be a talking point and maybe it would happen, but you talk about teams having their goal for the season is obviously to get back to the Eastern Conference Finals, but the way that everything, broke this year, they have to face the odds on favorite in the second round. So if they lose to mm-hmm. them there in the second, it's the same as if they had lost to them in the third, as far as I'm concerned. So
yeah, that's fair.
I don't see it being a big problem unless it's like really an embarrassing, like
yeah.
run out of town four game series. But I don't think that it would be at all.
Right. And that's fair. That's what I was saying. If that did happen the reason I asked that question is because if that happened, I think I would fire him. And I don't think, as you said, I don't think that will happen, but I think at that point, you know, if your ultimate goal is to beat Cleveland and you just get that spanked by a Cleveland team that hasn't been playing particularly well and looks as vulnerable as it ever has, that's kind of, well, what are we doing here? So what are we doing here moment, right?
Thing about that is, like, take away those two, the Game 3 and Game 4 wins in the Eastern Conference Finals last year, and that basically was pretty close to being the case.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
And that would have robbed us of this year, and there's a lot of good stuff that happened with the team this year. And if everything had, you know, if health hadn't been such a big concern, and like with the acquisitions they had made, like Cleveland looking as weak as they have on defense and as vulnerable as they've looked as a contender, you know, you very well could have looked at the Raptors as a finals contender. And we would have been denied that if we had overreacted to an Eastern Conference Finals series last year. So
it's true.
I think it'd be worth running it back again, and I'm a big fan of that because I think that, you know, people look at like a situation like the Clippers or something like that, and the fact that how long they've been together, and Bill Simmons and Haralabob Vulgaris were talking about that today on the Ringer.
Yeah, I haven't heard that one yet.
Yeah, I was listening to that before we recorded, cool. And I was basically they were talking about this concept of, do you run it back, and you know, at the end of the day, the championship is basically reserved for the Warriors for the next several years.
yeah.
you might get people that challenge them for it. And obviously the Cavs are the defending champs. You got to give them the benefit of the doubt a little bit, but at the end of the day, why, if you have a good team and like, what is your ultimate goal? If your ultimate goal is to be better than the Warriors, then like there are literally like 28 teams that should just pack it in. And you know, you don't do that because playoff series and finals are often champions are usually defined by, you know, injury luck on other teams. and anything can happen. And if you've got a team that's consistently good, why wouldn't you run it back? Like there's this idea, like I'll use the Clippers as the example again. They were earlier this year, if it hadn't been for the for those injuries early on, like they were having a really good beginning of the season. Everyone was saying like all of a sudden, okay, could they contest with the Warriors? And it's like the Raptors, if they could have very well, and they still might be a challenge for Cleveland this year, and the way that team is constructed. So, you know, how things go, I don't like overreacting to how things go in one particular series or game. Mm-hmm. I know that's typically how sports works, and like, you know, someone will get fired if they, you know, consistently lose in the first round. But the circumstances of each first round really, in the long run, it means something. Like you can't completely just throw it out the window and look at it completely objectively and say like, okay, no, you lost three first rounds in a row. Yeah, it's like, yeah, but I lost those to this isn't the Raptors case, but I'm just saying you, you lost the first round series 3 years in a row. It's like, yeah, but they were to historically great teams. So like, what standard are you holding me to?
Sure. Yeah, that's completely fair. And I think that you can only do that again, as you mentioned earlier, if you had someone that you wanted to replace him with. Like if, for example, obviously they've worked very closely with Jerry Stackhouse, who just won coach of the year in the D League. If that's someone they felt could make a positive change to the team. But again, I think everything you said is valid. And also we're speaking totally theoretically here, because I think if Toronto goes into a series with Cleveland, what Masai Ujiri is going to want to see ultimately is fight. Mm-hmm. And wherever this, you know, if the games are close and if they're fighting and it's, you know, it's another learning experience, another stepping stone, then I think you can stick with this, you know, the team the way it is, you know, make some tweaks, obviously, and you're going to need to based on their financial situation. But it gives you hope. It gives you a reason to keep things together. I was kind of speaking of a situation where it looked like there was really no hope, and maybe this thing was just a totally bad matchup altogether. So I think we're on the same page there. Okay. I'm trying to see if we have time for one more. Let's do one more quick listener question.
Okay.
And Francois, I'm sorry, your question's going to get bumped to next week, but we will definitely talk about it because it's not really a time-sensitive one. Malkin Pinto wants to know, why is Patrick Patterson playing so little and should he be playing more?
I think this really comes down to what we talked about before. Like the team is so deep. Mm-hmm. You really can't, and like for the sake of flow and things like that, in a playoff series, your rotation is usually cut down to about 8 or 9 people. And mm-hmm. if you've got 11 or 12 good players, yeah, you could play them, but it's just like there's no consistency, there's no flow, there's no, like it's hard to keep expectations in check. It's hard to, you know, for people to know their proper defensive assignments, things like that. And you have to shorten things. And like, he's the odd man out here, I think, just quite simply because other people are playing well enough to take his minutes.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Like, it's good. Yeah.
Like the role that Patterson has played with this team the last 3 or 4 years, like he has earned the right to be that guy, but no offense to him, but Serge Ibaka is a better version of him.
Much better.
So if you're, you know, he's playing in some situations where that used to be Patterson.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it comes to, yeah, they play well together, like that front court of Ibaka, Patterson and Tucker together, like what was like amazing in game 2. Mm-hmm. And that's good if you can get him in with those looks. But otherwise, like, you know, you're using Valanciunas some minutes, you're using Ibaka, Carroll and Tucker can both slide over to the 4. Like, there's only so many minutes to go around and someone's got to be the odd man out. And this whole thing now, if you look at the 9-man rotation of Powell, Carroll, Ibaka, DeRozan, Lowry, Tucker, Joseph, Valanciunas, and Patterson, that's, mm-hmm. that's basically their 9-man rotation that they used in game 5. Okay. You want Patterson had the fewest minutes of all those guys. It's like, okay, you can take away from someone else to give him more minutes, but I mean, the looks those other guys are giving you, like, I don't know who you're taking it from. Ibaka only played 24 minutes. Like, you don't want him to play less than that. Nope. Carroll only played 21, almost 22 minutes, and he had a great game. So, you know, you don't really need to take away from him. If Valanciunas is only playing 20 minutes, Corey Joseph, you can't even count that because he's a guard. Like, it's not the same thing. You're not taken from the same cookie jar, right?
Right.
So it's one of those things, man. You look at those nine guys, it's like some nights it's going to be the night for one guy, some nights it's going to be the night for the other guy. Like, you got to go with game flow, and the situation will dictate what you need to do. But the last couple of games, Patterson hasn't been the guy, but they've both been wins, so you can't really criticize the decision too much, can you?
No, totally not. Okay, we have a couple other great listener questions. Another one from Jeff McLeod and Francois, as I mentioned earlier. We're going to have to bump those to next week, unfortunately, because we're running a little short on time here. And I wanted to get to a special edition of This Day in Raptors History. Okay, so I'm going to be reading something here, Russ, so just bear with me, okay?
Okay.
As the Toronto Raptors approached their scheduled home opener at the Sky Dome on November 3rd, 1995, club president John Bitov could congratulate himself on having pulled off a remarkable achievement. Bringing NBA basketball back to Toronto, where the long-forgotten Toronto Huskies had tipped off against the New York Knickerbockers in 1946, had been an arduous process, fraught with obstacle after obstacle. It had not been such a struggle a half century ago, when the Huskies became a charter member of the Basketball Association of America, the forerunner of the NBA. In fact, Toronto had hosted the new league's first game on November 1, 1946, when the Knicks beat the Huskies 68-66. The Toronto franchise folded at the end of that season, however, and the NBA wouldn't return to Canada for nearly 50 years. Now here's where it comes in. The current franchise, the Toronto Raptors, traces its roots back to April 24th, 1993, which is the day we're recording right now, when the NBA announced that it had received a formal application from Professional Basketball Franchise Incorporated Canada. The ambitious group's president was Bitov, the son of a leading Canadian food services family, and president of Bitov Investments Incorporated. His father had previously approached the team about a franchise during previous expansions. The PBF group also included Alan Slade of Standard Broadcasting Limited, Borden Osmak of Vice President of the Bank of Nova Scotia, Phil Gronowski of Atlantic Packaging Limited, David Peterson, former Premier of the Province of Ontario, who served as chairman. The NBA's expansion into Toronto was unique for two reasons. First, it marked the league's first step beyond the border of the United States. And second, this group was one of only three viable prospective bid groups in the same city. In previous expansions, the NBA had been faced with choosing between competing cities, but never with such a strong internal rivalry for a franchise within a single market. There was little doubt, however, that Toronto wanted and could support an NBA franchise top caliber. Exhibition basketball games had twice drawn more than 25,000 fans to the Sky Dome in 1989 and 1992. For any listeners out there, the Sky Dome is where it's now known as the Rogers Center, and it's where the Blue Jays play, and that's where the Raptors played for their first couple of years. So I just wanted to say happy anniversary to the Raptors. This is their... So 1993 was when the paperwork was submitted, so it's been 24 years since there was the first inkling of a Raptors team. They're up 3-2. They're hopefully heading to the second round, and they're in the best spot they've ever been as a franchise. There's a really great article here. It goes for a long, long time. I was going to read the whole thing, but I'm not. You can find it on NBA.com if you just go to Toronto Raptors History, and it's pretty awesome. It's got a lot of really cool details about them naming the team, with the final top 10 list, Russell, of team names such as the Beavers, the Bobcats, which I did not know, the Dragons, the Grizzlies, the Hogs, because Toronto's nickname is Hogtown, the Raptors, the Scorpions, the T-Rexes, the Tarantulas, and the Terriers. We'll have to have a talk about that when we talk about our Huskies podcast and see. Maybe we'll do a Twitter poll and we'll see what people would rename the team now.
I remember that, and I actually remember voting on it. I think there was a voting process.
Yeah, I thought the Towers was also another one because of the CN Tower.
Perhaps.
But anyway, yeah, this day in Raptors history, the Raptors, paperwork was submitted, and the beginnings of what has become our beloved franchise came to the fore. So I wanted to say happy anniversary to the Raptors.
That's a really nice pull, man. Good job.
Thank you. I did a lot of furious Googling.
Yeah.
I was going through all the
questions. That sounds so dirty.
Yeah, just aggressive Googling. I was trying to go through all the different playoff games, and I don't think they've ever actually played a playoff game on this date before. It's always been the 23rd or the 26th or all over the place. Or there was some, I think there was one, but it was a horrible game against Detroit. So I wanted a happy memory. Yeah, happy memory. So, Russell, where can the people find us?
Oh, man. Where can't they find us? if you want to find us on Twitter, we have a cute little account there that's gaining some steam, at We the Rapscast. Our Facebook page is a good place to get our, you know, our weekly posts, any additional, things that we release outside of, the show on Dash. You can find that at, facebook.com/WeTheRapsCast. And, this listener feedback that we get into, we like to do that, on Twitter. We tend to survey people, but also you can email us at, WeTheRapsCast@gmail.com.
Absolutely. And I really do appreciate the listener questions. I've had a group of guys who are giving me some every week, and I'm trying to get to all of them. We obviously had so many this week, we couldn't get to all of them, which is kind of cool. Even sorry to the people that we didn't get to, but for us, it's nice to see that more people are asking and, that we're kind of gaining a little bit of steam.
My people really have to step it up, man. You come into these segments. We both put up the same messages basically on our Twitter feeds. Yeah. And, you know, I have a pretty good sampling of followers, and, you always come in with like this slew of questions, and I have like zero or one. I really have to get on my guys to step their game up.
Totally. I'll expect some more questions from Russell's friends next week.
Yeah, really. Maybe I'll remember to post it before like 5 Eastern, but
yeah, for sure. Did you know, before I get to the last part here, the silver in the Raptors original logo was Naismith silver in honor of James Naismith, the inventor of basketball?
Oh, wow. I did not know that. And for that case, it's cool that it's still kind of there too, which is nice. I'm actually, and this can be an episode all in of itself, this off season as well. But, my wife just revealed to me that for my birthday, she's got a trip for us planned down to Springfield to go to the Hall of Fame.
Ah, very cool. I've never been.
I have also never been, so I'm really looking forward to that. So I'll, you know, it'll be cool to take that in. And, of course, the Naismith Hall of Fame with the Canada roots being the first game being with Toronto and, the Huskies, my beloved Huskies. And, again,
and the Knicks. Yeah. And the Knicks. Damn Knicks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Oh man, that sounds like a great trip. I've always wanted to go there. I'll have to figure it out.
Yeah, I'm really excited. There's a Groupon or something going on now that she saw, that she got the idea from.
Great. Cool, yeah, man. All right. Well, I am Slammin' Dan. I'm Dan Grant is my real name. I've become synonymous with my Twitter handle. I am Dan Grant at Slammin' Danny G on Twitter.
You're a pretty slamming guy, no doubt.
Thank you.
I'm Russell Pedal, at Rusty Pedal Bike on Twitter.
And you can get out the salami and cheese, mama, because this podcast is over. Go Raptors. Whoa, whoa.